Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Bradley by Charles Whiting. Narrated by Dallas Britt. Introduction by Constantine Fitzgibbon. From December of 1942 until early in 1944, I was on the intelligence staff of Edo USA, the European Theater of Operations, United States Army, and from the late summer of 1943 was, as a very junior officer, marginally involved in the plans for the Normandy invasion, Neptune, and for the larger operation to follow, a successful landing, Overlord. When the United States 12th Army Group was created in, I think, early 1944, I was promoted in function. Those of us selected as the embryonic staff of this near headquarters and already in London were moved from Grosvenor to Bryanston Square, and I was put in charge of the German order of the battle map. It was my duty to tell our general what our most secret sources of intelligence believed German troop dispositions to be at any time, and, therefore, what deductions could be drawn as to the enemy's intentions. Since our headquarters was not to become operational until well after we should have landed in Normandy, Bryanston Square was essentially training, as was a trip I was sent on to Algiers and Caserta that spring. At the least, a part of that training was to teach the young man I then was, and the other raw staff officers, the nature of the relationship between the supposed expert on the facts and the commander who must base his decisions on those facts as presented to him by his staff. But our army group had at first no commander. The nameplate of General George Catlett Marshall was, briefly, on his enormous, unintended office. It was replaced by that of General Omar Bradley, a soldier and a man for whom I have, and shall always retain, a feeling of total and quite unabashed hero worship. An emotion to which I may say I was no more susceptible then than I am now. In London, I saw him almost every day, often more than once. Our relationship was entirely impersonal. I doubt if I ever so much as lit a cigarette in his presence. The only conversation that I recall with him which was not directly connected with his own activities as a commanding general took place in France. He walked into the intelligence caravan one hot afternoon and found me, in a quiet moment, reading War and Peace, a book he obviously knew very well. I asked, impertinently, whether he did not see some resemblance between his own position at the height of a great campaign with that of Marshal Kutuzov, caught between remote political masters who did not always understand and subordinate generals sometimes impetuous and difficult to control. And at headquarters at that time, we all tended to regard Eisenhower as a politician rather than a soldier. He told me sternly that he saw no resemblance, and since my maps had nothing new to reveal at that hour, he left me to my novel. He himself, no doubt, returned to planning how best to defeat the German armed forces facing the armies that he commanded. These he never spoke of, and almost certainly never thought of as his armies. Being a very good general indeed, General Bradley would do much of his planning in front of the intelligence map. There was a formal briefing each evening, which he attended accompanied by his senior staff officers. I would then brief him about the day's activities of the German army. Charlie Kindleberger, now a famous economist, about the German Air Force, another officer on German logistics, and occasionally other experts would follow, such as a ballistics man on the qualities of a new German tank gun, a demolitions expert, and so on. After this, General Bradley and his senior staff officers would usually discuss future plans and operations. This was of the greatest value to us junior intelligence officers, since it taught us to see which aspects of enemy activity we must attach particular importance to, amidst the mass of information that passed across our desks. Nor was that General Bradley's sole daily visit to the I caravan or map room when later we were in billets. He would quite frequently simply drop in, and when other generals were visiting his headquarters, corps and army commanders, occasionally Field Marshal Montgomery, very rarely General Eisenhower, he would bring them to our map, there to discuss plans and sometimes even to give orders. That was how I came to know General George Patton, and I shall tell one anecdote that illustrates the difference between Patton, the subject of Charles Whiting's earlier book in this series. I always thought a most unpleasant man, and Bradley himself. It was September 1944, and by then Patton was in eastern France, closing on the German frontier. We received intelligence of an attack about to come in on his ill-guarded right flank by a couple of German panzer brigades. 12th Army Group was on the move, and so, as usual, was 3rd Army. Our only means of communication was radio, and this item of intelligence was from a source that we were strictly forbidden ever to send over the air. The German attack was to come in at dawn. It was once again mid-afternoon, and I was alone and in charge. For my colonel, Bill Jackson, later President Eisenhower's special advisor on defense, was out. The G2, General Siebert, was also out, and so was General Bradley. There was nobody else whose advice I was permitted to ask as to what I should do. I decided that there were many excellent precedents for disobedience in times of military or naval crisis. Wrapped up the information as best I could to safeguard the source, and sent it over the air. Patton moved some armor to protect his flank, and when the attack came in at dawn, quite easily beat it off. 3 weeks later, General Bradley sent for me, looking unusually stern. "Read this," he said. It was a communication from 3rd Army G2, stating that General Patton requested that I be court-martialed for a gross breach of security in having sent that signal over the air. Bradley asked me to explain. I told him what had happened, and he said, "Look, someone's got to answer this thing. I'm a very busy man. Draft a reply for my signature, will you?" Yes, indeed. My hero.
Chapter 1. Bradley the Man. History records that the long-jawed, bespectacled general ate an early breakfast, lingered a little over his second cup of coffee in the swaying wardroom, and then went on deck just after 5. To left and right, the vast armada of thousands of big and little ships still lay silent. The coast that June morning was not yet visible. Weather had forecast there would be coastal mist anyway. At 05:30 hours, the 8-inch turrets of the cruiser, the USS Augusta, began to swing slowly towards the shore. The general took the piece of cotton wool proffered by an aide, tore it in two, and stuffed both his ears full. The shooting was about to start. It did, at 05:50 hours precisely, when the American vessel opened fire with a roar. The general swung his binoculars round as the first salvo hushed over the waiting armada. Little violent stars of light erupted along the shore, striking targets which had been painstakingly selected from thousands and thousands of aerial photographs during the years that this operation had been in planning. The invasion of Europe had begun. On that 6th day of June, 1944, the general with the homely features sweated out an operation, the success of which could mean the kind of fame which he would not have even dreamed about 6 months before. But failure would mean the abrupt end to a meteoric career of these last 26 months. At 0645, word reached him that the first wave of invading troops had scrambled ashore. He choked down a cup of scalding hot coffee, worrying now that although the enemy knew the Americans were there, he had not yet opened up with his coastal defenses. 2 hours later, there was still no news from the Fifth Corps confirming the landing. The only reports from the shore that the general could pick up over the Navy set were alarming and fragmentary. They spoke of sinkings, swamped boats, huddled, frightened men in the sand, chaos and confusion on the beaches. It was nearly 1,000 hours before the general heard from his Fifth Corps commander that his corps had landed, and the latter's message was in no way reassuring. It reported, "Obstacles mined, progress slow. DD tanks for Fox Green swamped." 2 hours later, Fifth Corps reported that the situation was still critical at all four exits from the landing beach. The troops were still pinned down and, in part, disorganized. The general now faced a major crisis, with this initial landing hours behind schedule and only part of the first wave of 34,000 troops and 3,300 vehicles ashore. He could now expect the arrival soon of the second wave, consisting of 25,000 soldiers and 4,400 more vehicles. What was he to do? Should he divert the second wave to the other beach at his disposal? But if he did, wouldn't the move materially affect the success of this landing? If he didn't, however, what was he to do with the second wave? Allow them to ride off ashore in their transports and face the ever-present danger of aircraft, submarines, and E-boats? Impotent, helplessly clinging to the radio for some word of hope, the general waited. At 1330 hours, the deadlock was broken. A message from Fifth Corps freed him from his fears. It was from Garreau, the corps commander, and read, "Troops formerly pinned down on beaches, Easy Red, Easy Green, Fox Red, advancing up heights behind beaches." The assault regiments had broken through the enemy defenses and were making their way up the cart tracks that led from the 7,000-yard-long beach. Soon, those cart tracks were going to be, as the general wrote years later, the most heavily trafficked roads in Europe. Reassured, the general went back to his supervision of the great operation, leaving this beach, Omaha, to check how the battle was going at his other landing site, Utah Beach. It was going better than at Omaha, but it had its problems too. He helped his corps commander to solve them the best he could, though he knew in his heart he was really almost powerless to change the course of the battle for the beaches. That depended upon a thin, khaki line of wet, exhausted soldiers. Late that night, wet and exhausted himself, but confident now that things were shaping up the way they should, he returned to his floating headquarters on the cruiser, riding in the bucking little wooden PT boat that had transported him between the two beaches. Once the general's failed craft was stopped by a U.S. destroyer which suspected the PT boat might be one of the enemy E-boats, which had already attempted to raid the beaches. "What in hell's the recognition symbol?" the PT boat's skipper yelled as he scrambled for his signal lantern. "Give it to me quick, or we'll have the whole damn Navy sweeping us with a broadside." Half amused and half concerned, the general turned to his aide and whispered, "I hope he finds it. This would be a hell of a way for a doughboy to end the war. skewered on the end of a 5-inch shell in 5 fathoms of water. But the skipper found the proper signal, and the general's boat passed on its way, only to be stopped once more within hailing distance of his mobile headquarters. An air raid had just begun, and the officer of the deck of the USS Augusta yelled to the PT boat skipper to lie off.
But we've got passengers aboard, the latter protested.
Prisoners? The voice in the darkness called from the Augusta's deck through a megaphone. There was a note of courtesy in it now. These would be the first POWs taken that fateful day.
Stand by to bring the prisoners aboard.
The PT boat stood by. The cold, wet, tired, and hungry general climbed up the rope ladder hanging down the cruiser's side and swung himself stiffly over the iron rail. The sailors crowded forward to get their first sight of the prisoners. Then they stopped.
Oh, hell, one of them grunted in disappointment. It's only General Bradley.
3 years before, the man who was soon to command the largest field army in the United States has ever sent overseas was a humble lieutenant colonel who could look back over 26 years of military experience during which he had never served outside the country of his birth or heard a shot fired in anger. In the same year that the man under whom he served on that June morning, Bernard Law Montgomery, was given command of his first corps, and the man against whom he would soon fight, Erwin Rommel, was already considering that command which would bring him worldwide fame. The Africa Corps, Omar Bradley, was still carrying out the same routine garrison duties that had been a daily and somewhat dreary part of his life for the best part of the last 3 decades. At the age of 48 years, it must have seemed to Omar Bradley that he had reached the peak of his military career when in February 1941, he was appointed the Commandant of the U.S. Infantry School. The post carried the rank of Brigadier General, and thus he became the first man of his West Point class to obtain the status of General. He could go no further. The United States was at peace. The war was thousands of miles away. A matter of the morning newspaper headlines and the evening radio newscast, and he could now look forward to coasting gently through the years to come to the day of his retirement, a major general at the most. Born in Clark, Missouri, on the 12th day of February, 1893, Omar Bradley was named Omar for an editor friend of his parents, and Nelson for the local town doctor. Save for 1.5 years in Hawaii, his parents, John Smith Bradley and Sarah Elizabeth, remained in the Clark-Hybe area until young Omar Nelson's father died in 1908. The 15-year-old high school student and his mother then moved to Moberly, also in Missouri. 2 years later, he graduated from high school and faced the question of what to do next in view of the fact that his mother, a seamstress, hadn't the money to support him through college. He found a job working in the locomotive workshops of the Wabash Railroad, hoping that in this way he could save enough in order to go to college. But he was fated never to go to the state university upon which his sights were set. In the late spring of 1911, the superintendent of the Christian church to which he belonged asks him why he didn't apply for an appointment to the Major Officer Training School of the United States Army, West Point. "But I couldn't afford to go to West Point," the young workman told the superintendent, John Cruson. "If I get to the university, I'll have a hard enough time earning my way." "You don't pay to go to West Point, Omar," the churchman lectured him. "The Army pays you while you're there." Young Bradley suddenly became interested in the career of soldier, but he was reluctant to waste his money on taking the necessary examination for entry, which was to be given at St. Louis. However, when the railroad for which he worked gave him a free pass for the journey, he went. 3 weeks later, he was informed that the other candidate for the appointment to West Point from his state had failed the exam. He had got the opening. He was to report to Academy on 1st August 1911. He was in the Army. As a member of the famous class of 1915, which was to produce so many officers who were to make their mark on the Second World War, including Dwight D. Eisenhower, he graduated 44th and was commissioned a second lieutenant of infantry on 12th June. But unlike so many of his fellow graduates, he was not fated to see action, either in Mexico or in the First World War. Like his friend Eisenhower, he was disgusted to hear that he had been given a home command. He had been appointed to a guard company of the 14th Infantry Regiment at the Butte Copper Mines. When the war ended without his having gone overseas, Bradley felt that his career was over. Surely the battle-experienced officers, such as the much-decorated Colonel Patton, who had served in France and had been wounded severely, would make the running? But in 1924, he finished second after Major Garrow, one day like Patton to be one of his Army commanders. In the Advanced Students Infantry course, in spite of the competition of battle-trained officers who had been overseas, his self-confidence returned. Over the next 15 years, his career plodded on steadily, full of the daily minutiae of an infantry officer's life in a peacetime garrison army, plagued by lack of money, its high points, a good performance report from his commanding officer, and the very, very occasional promotion. Only two things stick out as significant in those long interwar years, the salad days of the United States Army: his friendship with Dwight Eisenhower, progressing steadily forward in the staff, and his meeting with the then Lieutenant Colonel Marshall. For 2 years, Bradley served under that enigmatic American soldier when the colonel was the assistant commandant of the infantry school and he, Bradley, chief of the weapons section. Years later, when Marshall was made brigadier general, Bradley wrote to congratulate him. The new General Marshall replied in a letter which was brief but prophetic. "I very much hope we will have an opportunity to serve together again. I can think of nothing more satisfactory to me." That particular opportunity came in 1940, when Marshall, now Chief of Staff, ordered Bradley to his office as Assistant Secretary of the General Staff. A year later, Marshall transferred him to Fort Benning as Commandant of the Infantry School. Pearl Harbor came, and again, Marshall ensured that Bradley got a field command. His first division, the 82nd Infantry, which was later to achieve everlasting fame in its role as an airborne formation. A few months later, he got his second division, the 28th Infantry, also to do exceedingly well in Europe later, though occasionally it was dogged by bad luck. Thus, Marshall, that strangely reticent commander who did more than any other American soldier to prepare the United States Army for the conflict in Europe and the Pacific, switched Bradley back and forth, ensuring that the short space of 20 months before he finally went overseas, that he gained as much command experience as possible. Then, Bradley, like Eisenhower, figured largely in Marshall's plans for the future conduct of the war. Generals had always been inclined to nepotism ever since the days when officers purchased their commissions, and family connections were always much more important than military ability. But in the Second World War, there were two outstanding examples of commanders who promoted not on seniority or even on ability, but on the basis of personal knowledge of the officer concerned. In the British Army, Field Marshal Montgomery was outstanding on this score, being interested only in officers who had once formed part of the Monty Brookie team, Sir Alan Brooke, Chief of the Imperial General Staff, or had once been students of his at the Staff College. In the U.S. Army, Marshall, rationalizing that the average general officer under his command was over age at the commencement of war, often picked men of much junior standing to take over important posts. Eisenhower is a case in point. Being appointed to the post of Supreme Commander in Europe over the heads of 366 generals senior to him. And, in virtually every case, these junior men were officers who had at one time or other served with or under him. Even the overage Patton, who was 56 when he went overseas, owed his command clearly to the fact that he was a known quantity to Marshall, who had served with him in the First World War. Thus, it was that as 1942 gave way to 1943, General Marshall groomed his protege, as he had groomed General Eisenhower, for a senior command overseas. Though, as yet, neither Marshall nor Bradley knew what that command might be. But by the end of the United States' first year of war, Marshall was getting around to the realization that Bradley might be useful employed under Eisenhower in Africa. Visiting Eisenhower in Algiers that winter, he felt the major U.S. field commander in the West was running himself into the ground, trying to do too much. He told Eisenhower, who was suffering from flu, that in this sprawling theater, with demands on your time and attention all the way from Casablanca to Tunisia, you just can't get to all the places you might like to visit. You ought to have a man to be your eyes and ears. Naturally, he'd have to be a man who has ability and someone you can trust. Eisenhower replied that the suggestion would be fine if they could find the right man. Putting their heads together, the two generals began to discuss possibilities. Casually, Marshall mentioned Bradley's name. Eisenhower's reaction was spontaneous and immediate. "Go no further," he exclaimed. They had found Ike's eyes and ears. Omar Bradley landed in Algiers on the afternoon of 24th February, 1943. And although the two old college friends had only seen each other a half a dozen times at Army-Navy football games in their intervening years, Eisenhower immediately showed that he had complete confidence in Brad, giving the latter only a couple of days to acclimate himself. He sped him thereafter to the front to report on General Fredenau, whose Second Corps had suffered disastrously at the Kasserine Pass, taking a beating in the first major battle of American troops in the West. Bradley pulled no punches and did what was expected of him, reporting back to Eisenhower and asked what he thought of the command situation. He replied, "It's pretty bad. I've talked to all the division commanders. To a man, they've lost confidence in Fredenau as the corps commander." Eisenhower nodded his agreement. "Thanks, Brad," he said. "You've confirmed what I thought was wrong. As a matter of fact, I've already ordered Patton up from Rabat. He'll report in tomorrow to take command of Second Corps." Thus, General Blood and Guts Patton appeared on the scene, and for better or worse, the fates of the two men, Bradley and Patton, were to be linked for the rest of the war. Patton, profane, outspoken and energetic as usual.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?